smearing from black gums. Nice. I held out a warning paw. Don't even think about it, Squirt. I want answers, Bartimaeus. Answers. And if not, see this spear? I'll make you eat it before I'm done. The words came tumbling from his twisted mouth. His eyes were wide and staring like a fish. He seemed a little upset. You? You'd only recognize the sharp end if you sat on it. My voice was velvet smooth. Be careful, though. I'm not exactly defenseless myself. From my paddy paw, a talon popped, curved like a sickle moon. I turned it idly so it caught the light. He grinned nastily. Ah, but that's all show, isn't it? 2 days ago you weren't even able to talk, let alone resist attack. I'm betting if I prod you with this silver here, you'll know about it. And you won't be able to reverse it on me, either. He was right, unfortunately. If he'd zapped me with a punishment spell, I could have turned it back on him. A major benefit of knowing his birth name. But I had no such defense against an actual spear thrust, especially in my current debilitated state. You reckon? The lioness drew herself up to her full height. Her tufty ears scraped the ceiling. Them's mighty big words, stranger. Go ahead and prove 'em. He snarled, lunged weakly with the spear. The lioness flinched sideways and sliced down at the spear shaft with her claw. It was a pathetic display all round. We both missed by miles. What sort of thrust you call that? The lion scoffed, hopping from one foot to another. You're like a blind sparrow pecking for a worm. You were no better. The magician was shuffling from side to side within his pentacle, ducking down, jerking up, feinting with his spear in every direction known to man. He wheezed, he gasped. He displayed all the skill of someone whose servants normally lift his knife and fork. Hey, I said, I'm this way, to the front. Answers, Bartimaeus, he cried again. Tell me the truth. No delays, no evasions. Who summoned you? I'd expected this. But I couldn't tell him that Kitty was still alive, of course. However misguided she was, she treated me with honour. The lioness looked sheepish. A confusing analogy, but you get the idea. Who says anyone summoned me? I do, and don't deny it. I tried last night, and you were gone. Who was it? Which magician were you seeing? Don't get so worked up. It was a brief encounter. Nothing serious. It's over. Nothing serious? Another jab with the spear, this time pronging the floorboards. Think I'm going to believe that? Calm down, Mr. Jealous. You're making a scene. Who was it? Man or woman? I tried to be reassuring. Look, I know what you're thinking, and I didn't. Is that good enough for you? No. You expect me to trust a word you say? So much for reassurance. The lioness reverted to barefaced cheek. Confusing again, sorry. All right, then. Trust this. Get lost. It's none of your business. I owe you nothing. The boy was so angry, I thought he was going to burst out of his suit. It was the fear in him, of course. The fear of me passing on his name. Listen, sonny, I said. I never pass information from one master to another unless it's firmly in my interests. So don't expect me to say anything to you about last night. By the same token, I've not told anyone your pathetic little birth name. Why should I? It means nothing to me. But if you're so worried about me revealing your childhood secrets, there's a simple solution. Dismiss me for good. But no, you can't bring yourself to do that, can you? In fact, I don't think you actually want to break away from your past. That's why you keep me around, no matter how weak I get. It's so you can hang on to the Nathaniel you once were, as well as the big, bad John Mandrake you've become. The magician said nothing, but looked at me blankly with his hot and hollow eyes. I couldn't blame him. I was a bit surprised myself, in actual fact. Don't know where those piercing insights came from. All the same, I wondered if they rather went over his head. He wasn't looking well. We were in his study. It was, I guessed, late afternoon. Papers were strewn about the place. There was an uneaten plate of food upon his desk. The air had a sour, stale smell that suggested prolonged occupation by an unwashed youth. And sure enough, the youth in question was not his usual dapper self. His face was puffy, his eyes red and wild. His shirt, distressingly unbuttoned, hung over his trousers in sloppy fashion. All very out of character. Mandrake was normally defined by his rigid self-control. Something seemed to have stripped all that away. Well, the poor lad was emotionally brittle. He needed sympathetic handling. "You're a mess," I sneered. "You've lost it big time. What's happened? All your guilt and self-loathing suddenly get to you? It can't just be that someone else called me, surely." The boy looked up into the lioness's crystal eyes. "No," he said slowly. "I've other cause for complaint, too. And you're at the heart of it all."
"Me?"
And there was I, lamenting my decline. Looked like there was life in the old jinni yet. I perked up. "How so?"
"Well."
He set the spear against the ground, narrowly avoiding impaling his toe.
"I'll just run through it for you, shall I?
Firstly, in the last 24 hours there have been a number of serious riots in London. The commoners have caused much damage. There has been fighting and some casualties. Even now there is disorder on the streets. This morning Devereux declared a state of emergency. Troops have blockaded Whitehall. The machinery of empire has been seriously disrupted."
"Sounds like a bad day at the office for you," I said. "But nothing to do with me."
He coughed.
"A certain frog," he said, "began it all 2 nights ago by causing chaos in St. James's Park. Thanks to his actions, a dangerous jinni was set loose among the crowd. It was this incident that triggered the riots."
The lioness uttered a roar of protest.
"That was hardly my fault.
I was trying to carry out your orders in a thoroughly weakened state. I succeeded in difficult circumstances."
"Stop, don't laugh like that, it's creepy."
The youth had thrown his head back and uttered a hollow, barking laugh, not dissimilar to a hyena's.
"Succeeded?" he cried. "Is that what you call it? Nearly expiring at my feet? Unable to give me one word of the report I'd asked for? Making me look a fool in public? If that's success, give me failure any time."
"I made a fool of you?"
The lioness could barely contain her mirth.
"Get real. You don't need any help on that score, chum.
What did I do?
Draw attention to your cruelty, perhaps, on account of being nearly dead. What magician keeps a jinni in this world till it's too weak to survive? I'm surprised you didn't finish me off."
Mandrake's eyes blazed.
"They wanted to," he cried. "They wanted to wrest the information from you and let you die. Fool that I am, I saved you. I let you go, which left me with no defense against all the destruction you caused. As a result, my career's almost certainly finished. Maybe even my life, too. My enemies are gathering. I'm due for trial tomorrow, thanks to you."
His voice quavered. His eyes were moist. You could practically hear the sound of wistful violins. The warrior lioness stuck out her tongue and made a disrespectful noise. "That could all have been avoided," I said savagely, "if you'd trusted me enough to dismiss me more. I'd have been in better nick then, and could have easily avoided Hopkins' demons." He looked up quickly.
"Ah, so you found Hopkins?"
"Don't change the subject. I was saying it's all your fault. You should have had faith in me. But even after all these years, after what I did for you with Lovelace, with Duval, with the anarchist and the oyster—" He winced. "Don't mention that last one." "Even after all that," I continued remorselessly, "you reverted to type. Became a typical magician, treated me like an enemy. I'm a nasty demon, therefore I can't be trusted to—" I broke off.
"What?"
"Listen, that laugh of yours is really getting to me."
"But that's just it," he cried. "You can't be trusted. You do lie to me.
Name one occasion." His eyes glittered.
"Kitty Jones."
"I don't know what you mean."
"You told me she was dead. I know she's alive."
"Ah." My whiskers drooped a tad. "Have you seen her?"
"No."
"Then you're mistaken." I rallied as best I could. "She's as dead as they come."
"I've never seen deader.
That golem swallowed her down whole. Gulp, smack of the lips, gone. Sad, but still nothing to be worrying yourself about all these years later." I petered out here. I didn't like the look in his eyes. Mandrake nodded slowly. Red swathes of anger competed with white blotches for possession of his face. It was a tie, a 50-50 split.
"Swallowed whole, was it?" he said. "Funny. I seem to remember you said the golem burned her to a crisp."
"Oh, did I? Yes, well, he did that, too. First. Before the swallowing bit. Ouch!" Without warning, the magician had raised the spear and jabbed. I was too slow, too weak to react. The spear caught me firmly in my midriff. I gasped in shock, looked down, and relaxed again. "Wrong end," I said. "That's the blunt bit." Mandrake had noticed this, too. With a curse of frustration, he hurled the spear away from him, out of the circle. He stood staring at me, breathing hard, attempting to master his emotions. A minute or so passed. His heart rate slowed.
"Do you know where she is?" I asked.
He said nothing. I spoke quietly.
"Leave her alone. She's doing you no harm. And she saved your life, remember?"
I didn't lie about that. He seemed about to speak, then gave his head a little shake, as if forcibly flinging the subject from his mind.
"Bartimaeus," he said, "I stated to you the other day that I would dismiss you if you completed your mission, and despite the endless provocation, I stand by my word. Tell me what happened when you followed Jenkins, and I will let you go."
The lioness's brawny arms were folded. She looked down on him from a great height.
"Permanently?"
His eyes flicked to the side.
"I never said that.
But I am. Unless I'm much mistaken, my information's the only thing that might prevent you from going to the tower. Correct?" He gritted his teeth.
"I believe that Hopkins is engaged in some conspiracy. If I can foil it, my position will probably be safe. Yes."
"So then, how about it? It's good info I've got here. You won't be disappointed." His voice was practically inaudible.
"All right, if it's good enough."
"It is."
"Good.
That's more like it. A sensible agreement, just like the old days."
"You know, Mandrake," the lioness said musingly, "things were better when you were little. You had more sense then."
He glowered at his feet.
"So I'm told. Well, get on with it."
"All right." The lioness linked her paws together, cracked her knuckles, and began.
"I follow Jenkins all across London. He's got a network of magicians involved in his schemes. 7 in total, all a bit like him. Low-level, embittered, weak in strength, nothing to be afraid of on the face of it, for someone tough like you."
"Any names?" The magician was listening intently, absorbing it all.
"Withers and Burke?"
"Nope, didn't mean anything to me either. But you'll know this one."
"Lime."
Mandrake's eyes opened wide.
"Rufus Lime? Lovelace's friend? That's more like it. Is he still—"
"Yep. As fish-faced as ever. Just got in from Paris, apparently."
"And their plans? What details did you get?"
"Nothing concrete, to be frank. They're all busy choosing demons for it, whatever it is. But they're magicians. That's what you'd expect them to do. There was much talk about ropes and chains. Oh, and vans." He wrinkled his nose.
"Vans?"
"Go figure. They mentioned something about an experiment, too. They wanted proof it had been successful. No idea what, though." I scratched an ear.
"What else?"
"Oh, Jenkins said there were 7 of them, because it was 1 for each chair." Mandrake grunted.
"The council? There are 7 of us. They plan rebellion."
"As usual."
"Well, it's interesting, but rather short on specifics."
Mandrake looked quizzically at me.
"For this, you expect dismissal?"
"There's more. Jenkins didn't just visit some downbeat friends. He met someone else. I'll give you 3 guesses."
"Who?"
"Go on, guess."
"Oh, you're no fun.
I'll give you a clue. Beard."
"Oh, well done.
I didn't give an answer."
"No, but I can tell you've got it right, from the colour you've gone."
Well, for the record, it was an interesting yellow-white, sort of custardy.
"Yep. The mercenary's back in town, and his brows are even more beetling than you remember. With utmost bravery and cunning, I attached myself to his 7-league boots and followed him to the park, where he met a man I can only assume to be the elusive Hopkins. No, I didn't hear a word, they said. That's when their gin spotted me. You know the rest. I left half my essence between there and Richmond.
All very well, Mandrake snapped. But what good is this to me? I can't act on any of it. I need something if I'm to survive the trial tomorrow. Hopkins, he's the key. Can you describe him?
The lioness scratched her nose. Funny, it's hard. He's sort of undistinguished-looking. A bit stoop-shouldered, maybe. Plain face, unshaven. Mousy hair, I think. Why are you holding your head in your hands? He cast his face to the ceiling.
Ah, it's hopeless. I might have known not to give this task to you. Ascobol could have done a better job.
That needled me. Oh, really? So he'd have found out where Hopkins lived, would he?
What?
He'd have got the exact address, would he? I can see it now. A big fat cyclops in a raincoat and trilby, sidling up to Jenkins and the mercenary in the cafe, ordering a coffee, trying to listen in. Oh, yes, very inconspicuous.
Never mind all that. You know where Hopkins is? Tell me.
He's staying at the Ambassador Hotel, I said. There. Just a little something I picked up, when I wasn't being chased to within a spoonful of my life. A technical term, a measurement of essence.
Wait! What are you doing?
The magician had sprung into sudden action. Turning to face the other pentacles laid out on the floor, he cleared his throat and rubbed his tired red eyes.
I've got one chance, Bartimaeus, he said. One chance, and I'm going to take it. Tomorrow my enemies will strike me down unless I've something tangible to show them. And there will be few things more tangible than Mr. Hopkins, trussed and tied.
He flexed his fingers, began an incantation. A cold wind whipped around my ankles. A melancholy howling filled the air. Honestly, effects like this were frowned upon in Uruk for being hackneyed and out of date. The last time I used that strong wind, disembodied howling gag was to distract the giant Humbaba up in the pine forests so that my master Gilgamesh could creep up from behind and slay him. We're talking 2600 BC here, and it only worked then because Humbaba was a few pine cones short of a fir tree. You wouldn't see any modern magician leave the pentacle on account of that racket unless they'd collapsed laughing. I shook my head grimly. No prizes for guessing who was coming. Sure enough, with a noise like a cracked dinner gong, the blond-haired giant materialized in the next pentacle along. Instantly he set up a feeble torrent of pleading and complaint, which his master sensibly ignored. He hadn't seen me. I waited till he was on his knees, wringing his hands and begging for dismissal, then kind of coughed suavely. "Need a handkerchief, Ascobol? My feet are getting wet." The Cyclops stood hurriedly, his face a flaming mask of shame and disapproval.
"What's he doing here, sir?" he bleated. "I really don't think I can work with him."
"Don't worry," I said. "I'm just watching you get your orders. After that, I'm out of here. Aren't I, sir?" Mandrake ignored us both. He had continued with his incantations, directing his energy at the remaining pentacles in the room. Further cheap effects ensued, pops and bursting. Squeaks and sounds of running feet. Smells of egg, gunpowder, and methane. It was like a kid's birthday party. All we lacked were the silly hats. Within seconds, the usual suspects had joined us. The rest of Mandrake's crowd. It was a mixed bag. First and least, we had Ascobol, glowering at me between his braids. Next up was Cormac Codron, a humourless cove, third level, who'd done time in Ireland during the Celtic twilight. He favoured the guise of a man-boar, with tusks and trotters daubed with bright blue woad. Beyond him was a Mwamba, a jinni who had worked with the Abulaya tribes of eastern Africa. I had a bit of time for her. She didn't indulge in the tedious comments of the others. Today, for reasons best known to herself, she appeared as a giant spiny lizard, wearing leather thigh boots. At the far end, barely squeezing himself into his pentacle, was Hodge. All prickles, odours, and bad personality. The five of us had worked together frequently over the preceding months, but sadly none of the others shared my upbeat temperament. Mwamba was as flighty as a butterfly,
Cormac Codron, taciturn and brutish, while Ascobol and Hodge were just insufferable, being regrettably prone to sarcasm. We'd had friction, harsh words. Our relationship now could best be described as strained. Mandrake wiped sweat from his forehead. "I have summoned you," he said, "for what I hope will be the final time." This stirred a bit of interest, but was shuffling, coughing, rasping of spines. "If you complete today's mission," he continued, "I will not call on any of you again. I hope this vow will be sufficient for you to carry out this charge to the letter." Cormac Codron spoke. His voice rumbled between his tusks. "What is the charge?" "Staying at the Ambassador Hotel is a human named Hopkins. I wish you to arrest him and bring him here to this room. If I am absent, wait within the Pentacles until I return. Hopkins is probably a magician. Certainly he has allies who can raise low-level djinn, although from what we have seen, they are unlikely to be powerful enough to trouble you. More dangerous than Hopkins is a tall, black-bearded man. Not a magician, though he possesses the ability to withstand magical attack. This individual may or may not be present at the hotel. If he is, and you can capture or kill him, all well and good. But it is Hopkins that I need."
"We shall want a description," Humwamba hissed, "and a good one. All you humans look alike to me."
Ascobol nodded.
"Don't they just? They're all the same basic shape, got the same number of limbs and heads. Mind you, there's a few bits that vary. If you look at—"
Mandrake held up his hands hurriedly. "Indeed. Fortunately, Bartimaeus has encountered Hopkins, and will be able to guide you." I gave a start.
"Wait a minute! That's not on! You said I was to go free when I told you what happened."
"Agreed. But your description of Hopkins was rudimentary, incomplete. I cannot act on it. Go with the others, point out Hopkins. That's all. I don't expect you to tackle him in your condition. When you get back, you will be dismissed." He turned to the others and began giving additional instructions, but the lioness heard nothing. My tufted ears were buzzing with rage. I was so furious I could barely stand. The arrogance of it! He was happy to renege on a vow so recent its echoes were still resounding through the room. Very well, I'd go. I had little choice. But if he ever got within my power, Mandrake would rue the times he'd cheated me. The magician finished. "Any further questions?"
"Are you not coming with us?"
Hodge inquired. He was shifting and adjusting his great stickleback skin coat. "No," Mandrake scowled. "Regrettably, I must attend the theatre. What remains of my career depends upon it. Also," he glanced at me, I couldn't read the meaning in his eyes, "perhaps I have another appointment, too." The lioness regarded him implacably. "You'll be making a big mistake." I looked away. "Come on, then," I said to the others. "Follow me." Chapter 18 Kitty. Throughout the day, Kitty had been out of humour. She was surly, withdrawn and prickly, even short-tempered, when challenged by her master. She completed her tasks dutifully, but without enthusiasm, slamming doors, stomping about the villa's rooms, and once, thanks to a hasty manoeuvre in a tight space, knocking over two high columns of carefully ordered books. Her master grew quite irritable in his turn.
"Have a care, Lizzie!" he cried. "My patience is wearing thin!"
Kitty halted opposite the sofa. Her forehead was creased with the blackest frown.
"Am I not giving satisfaction, Mr. Button?"
"Indeed not! All day you have been out of sorts, galumphing like a rogue elephant around my house, face as ugly as an afreet. When I address you, you answer rudely, without respect. I am shocked by your insolent vulgarity, and that tea you brewed me was as insipid as gnat's piss. This cannot go on. What is the matter with you, girl?"
"Nothing."
"Sullen again? I warn you, if it continues, you shall be out on your ear."
"Yes, sir."
Kitty sighed. It was, after all, not Mr. Button's fault that Bartimaeus had failed her.
"I'm sorry, sir. I've had a spot of trouble."
"Trouble?"
The lines of vexation on the old man's face softened.
"'My dear, you should have said. Tell me. Perhaps I can help.'
A flicker of anxiety crossed his brow.
"'It is nothing financial?'
"'No, sir. Nothing like that.' Kitty hesitated. She could hardly tell him the truth, but her whole purpose in assisting him had in the early hours of the morning been rendered futile. After almost 3 years, Mr. Button relied upon her. Despite his brisk manner, she knew he valued her highly, but he was still a magician.
"'It's my evening job, sir,' she said. "'You know I work at an inn. We had a demon raid 2 days ago. One of my colleagues was killed.'
"'A raid?'
Mr. Button frowned.
"'What for?' "'The usual stuff, sir. Trying to uncover dissent. People prepared to act against our leaders.'
She took a spice cake from the plate in front of him and bit into it listlessly.
"'Well, Lizzie, you must understand that it is the right of any government to protect itself. I am not sure you should be frequenting that inn, if it is such a hotbed of subversion.'
"'But it isn't really, sir. That's the point. All the commoners ever do is talk. About the war, the police, restrictions on their freedom. Just talk. They're powerless to do anything about it, as you must know.'
"'Hmm.'
Mr. Button gazed out of the grimy window at the blank October sky.
"'I can hardly blame the commoners for their unhappiness. The war has gone on far too long. I fear Mr. Devereux is not acting as he should. But what can we do? Even I, a magician myself, am helpless. Power is concentrated with the council, Lizzie. The rest of us must watch and hope for better times.' "'Well, well, I can understand your distemper if a friend of yours was killed. I am sorry for your loss. Have another cake.'
"'That's very kind. Thank you, sir.'
Kitty sat on the sofa arm and did.
"'Perhaps you should take the afternoon off, Lizzie,' Mr. Button said. "'I shall be working on my demonic index, and that will keep me busy. So many demons! You'd think the other place could scarcely cram them in.'
Kitty's mouth was full of cake crumbs. She swallowed them.
"'Pardon me, sir, but what exactly is the other place? I mean, what's it like?'
The old man grunted.
"'A region of chaos, a whirl of endless abominations. Dulac, if I remember rightly, called it a sump of madness. We cannot begin to imagine the horror of such a realm.'
He shuddered.
"'It's enough to make a man want a third spiced bun.'
"'So magicians have visited it?' Kitty asked. "'I mean, they'd have to have done, to know what it was like.'
"'Ah, well,' Mr. Button shrugged, "'not exactly. In general, the authorities used reports from reliable slaves. To venture there in person is another matter. It risks both body and soul.'
"'So it hasn't been done?'
"'Oh, it's been tried. Dulac's master, Ficino, for example.' He hoped to gain demonic power. Instead, he lost his mind. Literally so. It did not come back. As for his body... No, the details are too revolting.
Oh, go on, sir.
Certainly not. There has been a smattering of others, but all were left insane or worse. The only magician who claimed to have succeeded in the journey was Ptolemaeus. He left details in his apocrypha, but they are of dubious value. In effect, he implies that the procedure can only be achieved with the help of a benign demon whose name is invoked to create the gate.
He snorted.
Palpably, the notion is ridiculous. Who would seriously trust a demon with their life? And it is likely that Ptolemaeus himself suffered as a result of his experiment. By most accounts, he didn't live long afterward.
Trust. Bartimaeus had emphasized exactly that. Ptolemy had been willing to put his trust in him. As a result, there was no limit to their bond. Kitty gazed up at the ceiling, remembering the Jinni's challenge to step out of the circle. She hadn't done it for the obvious reason that he'd have probably torn her limb from limb. No trust there, on either side. A great anger flared inside her once again, anger for wasting so many years in pursuit of a hopeless dream. She slipped off the sofa arm.
"'Do you mind if I do take the afternoon off, sir?' she said. "'I think I need a little air.'
As she retrieved her coat from the hallway, she passed a pile of books that she had lately sorted, ready for stacking on some newly purchased shelves. Among them were works from the ancient Near East, within which she halted, checked. Yes, there it was, three from the top. A slim volume. Ptolemaeus' Apocrypha. Kitty curled her lip. What was the point? Bartimaeus had said it was written in Greek, claimed it would be useless to her. She moved away, only to stop again halfway down the hall. She looked back. Well, why not? It couldn't do any harm. Old investigative habits died hard. She departed the house with the book in her pocket. That evening, with time on her hands, Kitty walked to the Frog Inn. She had hoped the exercise would burn off a little of the frustration swelling uncontrollably inside her. But if anything, it only made it worse. The faces of the people she passed were pinched and sullen, their shoulders hunched. They gazed at their boots as they trudged along the road. Vigilant spheres whirled above the streets. Night police loitered arrogantly at major intersections. One or two roads were barricaded off. There had been disorder in central London. Now the authorities were cracking down. White police vans passed her more than once. Faintly she heard sirens in the distance. Her pace grew slower, her gaze dulled and unseeing. She felt weighed down by the utter futility of things. 3 years she had been shut up in libraries and dusty rooms, playing at being a magician. And all for what? Nothing had changed. Nothing would change. A cloak of injustice lay upon London, and she, like everyone else, was smothered by it. The council did what they pleased, oblivious to the suffering they caused, and she was unable to do anything about it. At the Frog, a similarly sombre mood prevailed. The taproom had been tidied, the devastation of 2 nights previously cleared away. At the end of the counter, a shiny new piece of wood filled the hole made by the demon's attack. It did not quite match the rest of the bar, but George Fox had disguised it with a display of postcards and horse brasses. All the broken chairs and tables had been replaced. The circular burn mark near the door was covered with a rug. Mr. Fox gave Kitty a subdued welcome.
"Extra work for us tonight, Clara," he said. "Haven't found anyone yet to, you know, replace Sam."
"No, no, of course not." Kitty's voice was mild, but impotent fury sloshed inside her. She felt she might scream. Grasping a cloth as if it were the neck of a magician, she went about her business. 2 hours passed. The taproom filled. Men and women huddled at the tables or stood talking quietly by the counter. An unenthusiastic darts match began. Kitty pulled drinks behind the bar, lost in her thoughts. She hardly looked up when the door opened, bringing with it a gust of autumn chill. As if a switch had just been pushed, or a battery pulled out, all conversation in the Frog suddenly wound down. Sentences were left unfinished. Glasses paused en route to open mouths. Eyes swiveled. A few heads turned. A dart embedded itself in the plaster wall beside the board. George Fox, who had been bent beside a table chatting, slowly drew himself erect. A young man stood there. He shook the rein off his long black coat. Kitty saw the newcomer between the heads of nearby customers. Her hand jerked, splashing gin upon the surface of the counter. Her mouth made a little noise. The young man removed his gloves. He ran a slender hand through his hair, short, cropped, and flecked with rain, and looked around at the silent room. "Good evening," he said. "Who is the proprietor here?" Silence. Shuffling. Then George Fox cleared his throat.
"That would be me."
"Oh, good. A word, please." The request was quietly spoken, but it held the assumption of authority. Everything about the young man did. His coat, his smart black jacket, the ruched white shirt, his patent leather shoes. In his own way, he was as alien a figure in the taproom with the Frog as the demon without a face. Animosity and fear rippled out around the room in waves. The young man smiled. "If you don't mind." George Fox stepped forward.
"What can I do for you?"
The young man was shorter than Mr. Fox by half a head, slim as he was burly.
"I believe you have a girl working here," he said. "What is her name?"
One or two of the customers standing at the counter flicked their eyes at Kitty, who had shrunk back against the cabinet behind the bar. The door to the passage was close. She could slip out through the kitchens and away. Mr. Fox blinked.
Clara Bell. She's the only girl since Peggy left.
His voice trailed off, was replaced with guarded hostility.
Why? Why do you ask?
Is Clara Bell working here tonight?
George Fox hesitated. Precisely the answer the young man was expecting.
Good, he said. Fetch her out.
He looked about him. Kitty was concealed behind the patron standing at the bar. She inched toward the backroom door.
"Fetch her out,"
the young man said again. Still George Fox did not move. His face was set in stone, his eyes bulging.
"Why do you want her?" he repeated stolidly. "Who are you? What do you want with her?"
"I am not accustomed," the young man said, his voice was tired, "to explaining myself, nor to asking more than once. I am from the government. That should be enough for any of you here." "Oh, sorry, I don't think so."
A man standing near the entrance had slipped from his seat and hurried to the door. He opened it, made to depart. The magician spoke a word and gestured. The man was flung backward, bodily, into the room, landing hard beside the fireplace. The door slammed shut so hard the brasses rattled on the walls.
"Not one of you leaves this room until Clara Bell is found."
The young man looked testily toward the commoner lying on the floor.
"Stop that groaning. You're not injured."
He turned back to George Fox.
"Well?"
Kitty was by the backroom door. One of the customers at the bar nodded his head almost imperceptibly.
"Go on," he hissed. "Get out."
The young man tapped a shoe upon the tiles.
"It won't surprise you to learn that I have not come to this hovel alone. Unless the girl is brought before me in 30 seconds, I shall issue orders that you will probably regret."
He glanced at his watch. George Fox looked at the floor. He looked at the ceiling, his hands clenched and unclenched. He tried not to meet the beseeching gazes of the people all around. Lines of weariness and age were etched upon his cheeks. He opened his mouth, closed it.
"It's all right, George."
Kitty pushed her way around the end of the bar. She carried her coat across one arm.
"You don't have to."
"Thanks." She walked slowly between the tables.
"Well, Mr. Mandrake, shall we go?"
For a moment the magician did not answer. He was staring at her, his pale face a little flushed, perhaps affected by the heat of the room. Collecting himself, he gave a slight bow.
"Miss Jones, I am honoured. Would you mind coming with me?"
He stood aside. Stiff-backed, staring straight ahead, Kitty passed him. He followed her to the door. The young man looked back at the silent room.
"My apologies for disrupting your evening."
He went out. The door closed. For almost a minute, no one moved or spoke.
"You'll be needing a new barmaid, George,"
someone said. In the yard, the vigilant sphere had gone. A few car lights moved on the road beyond the passageway. A light rain fell. Kitty heard it tapping against the river in the darkness below the parapet. Cool air brushed her face, and specks of dampness. Their sudden touch made her feel alive. Behind her, a voice.
"Miss Jones, my car is close by. I suggest we walk to it."
At the sound, a fierce exultation suddenly flowered in Kitty. Far from the fear she should have felt, she knew only defiance and a kind of joy. Since the first numb shock of Mandrake's appearance, she had been quite calm. Calm and curiously revived. For 3 long years she had led a solitary, cautious life. Now, with all its prospects shattered, she knew she could not have endured that life a moment longer. She wanted action, regardless of the consequences. Her old recklessness came flooding back to her upon a tide of frustrated rage. She turned. Mandrake stood before her. Mandrake, one of the council. It was like the answer to her prayers.
"So what are you going to do?" she snapped. "Kill me?"
The young man blinked. His face was dimly lit by lights from the old inn's windows. It gave him a sickly yellow cast. He cleared his throat.
No. I...
Why not? Isn't that what you do to traitors?
Kitty spat the last word out.
Or to anyone who crosses you?
One of your demons was here 2 nights ago. It killed a man. He had a family. He'd never done anything against the government, but it killed him even so. The magician made an irritable noise behind his teeth. That is unfortunate, but it is nothing to do with me.
No, except you control the demons.
Kitty's voice was hard and shrill.
They're just the slaves. You direct them.
I meant it wasn't me personally. That's not my department. Now, Miss Jones.
Sorry, she said, laughing. That is just the most lamentable excuse I've ever heard. Not my department. Ooh, that makes it all right, then. And I suppose the war isn't your department either. Or the night police, or the prisons in the tower. None of them are anything to do with you.
As a matter of fact, they're not. His voice grew stern. Now, can you manage to be silent on your own, Miss Jones? Or perhaps you wish my help? He clicked a finger. A shadow detached itself from the darkest corner of the yard. That is Fritang, Mandrake said. Most savage of my slaves. He will do whatever I can... Kitty gave a cry of derision.
That's right. Threaten me. Just like you threatened the people in the inn. Can't manage to do anything without force to back you up, can you? I don't know how you sleep at night.
That's rich coming from you, Mandrake snapped. I don't remember the resistance being afraid to use force when it suited them. Let's see now, what were the casualty figures? Several people killed, others maimed, and
that was different. We were fighting for ideals.
Well, so am I. However, he took a deep breath, I admit to being discourteous in the present instance. The magician waved a hand, spoke a word of dismissal. The menacing shadow faded into nothing. There, now you can talk without fear. Kitty looked directly at him.
I was not afraid.
Mandrake shrugged. He glanced back over his shoulder at the closed inn door, then out toward the road. In contrast to his imperious efficiency inside the frog, he seemed suddenly hesitant, unsure what to do.
Well, Kitty said, what normally happens next when you arrest someone? Spot of torture? A beating? What's it to be?
A sigh. I've not arrested you. At least not necessarily.
Then I'm free to go?
Miss Jones, he snarled, I am here as a private individual, not as a member of the government, though if you don't stop your histrionics, that may change. Officially, you are dead. Yesterday, I received word that you were alive. I wanted confirmation. Kitty's eyes narrowed.
Who told you I was here? A demon?
No, it is not important. Clarity came.
Ah, it was Nick Drew. I said it is not important. You cannot be surprised that I would want to find you, a fugitive from justice, a member of the resistance.
No, she said, I'm just surprised you haven't cut my throat already. The magician gave a cry of genuine annoyance.
I am a minister, not a murderer. I help protect our people against terrorists like you and your friends.
Yeah, because the people are so safe in your care, Kitty sneered. Half our young men are dying in America, and we've got the police mauling others in the street, and demons attacking anyone who protests, and enemies and spies at large in our suburbs. We're all having a great time.
If it wasn't for us, it would be much, much worse.
Mandrake's voice was high and tight. With evident effort, he lowered it to a purr.
We use our power to rule for the good of all. The commoners need guidance.
Admittedly, we're going through a ropey patch, but...
Your power is based on slavery. How can it be for anyone's good?
The magician seemed genuinely shocked.
Not human slavery, he said. Just demons. That makes it better, does it?
I think not. Everything you do is tainted with that corruption. His answer was faint.
That's not so.
It is so, and I think you know it. Kitty frowned at him.
What are you here for? What do you want?
The resistance was a long time ago. Mandrake cleared his throat.
I was told.
He drew his coat around him, looked out across the river.
I was told you saved me from the golem. That you risked your life to save mine.
He glanced at her. Kitty kept her face impassive.
I was also told you died doing it.
Now that I find you alive, I am naturally curious as to the truth. Kitty scowled. What do you want? The details? Yes, I did, and I must have been mad. I stopped the golem from crushing your sorry head into a pulp. Then I ran away. That's all there is to it. She stared at him fixedly. He gazed back, face pale and stark in the artificial light. The rain pattered down between them. Mandrake coughed. Well, the details are fine. Thanks. In fact, that wasn't exactly it, so much as I kind of wondered why. He shoved his hands in his pockets. I don't know, Kitty said. I really don't know. Put your coat on, he said. You're getting soaked. Like you care. Even so, she put it on. He watched her as she wrestled with the sleeves. When she had finished doing up the buttons, he cleared his throat again. Well, whatever your reasons might have been, he began, I suppose I need to Don't, she said. Don't. I don't want to hear it. Not from you. He frowned. But I did it without thinking. And if you want to know the truth, I've regretted it ever since. Whenever I've seen your hideous, lying leaflets on the streets, or past those stages where your actors do your lying for you. So don't thank me, Mr. Mandrake. She shivered. The rain had steadily intensified. If you must thank someone, make it Bartimaeus. He's the one who prompted me to save your life. Even in the dark, she could see it startled him. His posture stiffened. His voice grew brittle. He prompted you? I find that hard to credit. Why? Because he's a demon? Yeah, I know. Doesn't make much sense. But he told me how to stop the golem. He called me back when I would have run. Without him, you'd be dead. But don't let that bother you. He's just a slave. The magician was silent for a time. Then he said, I had been meaning to ask you about Bartimaeus. For some reason he regards you with affection. Why is that? Kitty's laugh was genuine. There is no affection between us. No? Why then did he tell me you were dead? He said the golem killed you. That is why I have not searched for you in all these years. He said that? I didn't know. Kitty looked out over the Black River. Well, she said, perhaps it was because I treated him with some respect. Perhaps because I didn't enslave him. Perhaps because I didn't seek to keep him in service for year after year without a break till his essence wore away. She bit her lip and looked quickly at the magician. His eyes were hidden in a strip of darkness. And what, he said very quietly, can you possibly know about that? You haven't seen Bartimaeus for years. Have you? Kitty edged back toward the river wall. The magician stepped toward her. A sudden hissing in mid-air. Raindrops fizzed and steamed on something materializing above the water. A small orb, pink and shiny. Music sounded, as of an orchestra far away. Mandrake drew back. He uttered a quiet curse. A faint, round face, disrupted by crackles of static, appeared in the orb. A voice issued forth, similarly disrupted.
John, I've found you. You are late. Even now the musicians are warming up. Come quickly.
The magician gave a little bow.
Quentin, my apologies. I have been delayed.
No time to waste.
The face seemed to fix on Kitty for a moment.
Bring your girlfriend, too. I shall save a seat. 10 minutes, John. 10 minutes.
The orb fizzed, blurred, vanished. Dark rain fell uninterrupted into the Thames. Kitty and Mandrake stared at each other. It seems, the magician said slowly, that we shall have to continue this conversation later. Do you like the theatre, Miss Jones? Kitty pursed her lips. Not much. Nor me. He made an elegant gesture up toward the road. We shall have to suffer together. Chapter 19. Bartimaeus. Our raid on the Ambassador Hotel was planned with military precision and the utmost care. Just 10 minutes bickering in a phone box, and we had the plan set straight. After leaving our master, we'd flown speedily across London in the guise of starlings, crossing above the park where so recently I'd had my misadventure. The glass palace, the pagoda, the ill-omened lake, all glinted dourly in the last light of evening. Most of the illuminations were off. The normal crowds were absent. Though small pockets of commoners moved here and there with unknown purpose across the grass, I saw police cordons, hurrying imps, an unusual amount of activity. Then we were over the streets of St. James and circling down to the hotel. It was an up-market affair, a slender grey stone house set among the embassies and gentlemen's clubs, a place both sophisticated and discreet, where foreign diplomats and princelings might rest their wallets while in town. It did not look the kind of hotel to welcome an invasion of five ragtag gin, particularly ones as unsavoury as Hodge. We saw hexes shimmering in the windows, and a lattice of thin nodes upon the fire escape. The doorman, resplendent in lime-green livery, had the sharp-eyed look of someone wearing lenses. Caution was required. We couldn't just stroll in. The phone box was right opposite. One by one, five starlings flew down behind it. One by one, five rats hopped through a hole inside. Mwamba used her tail to brush away the worst of the cigarette butts, and we began our solemn conclave. "Right, troops," I said brightly, "here's what I suggest." A one-eyed rat held up a paw of protest.
"Just a minute, Bartimaeus," it said. "What makes you the leader all of a sudden?"
"You want the full inventory of my talents? Remember, we have to capture Hopkins sometime this evening."
"If hot air counted for anything, Bartimaeus, we'd follow you with pleasure."
This was Cormac Odron. His basalt thick voice boomed about the phone box. The vibrations made my whiskers ripple.
"Unfortunately, you're old and tired and useless."
"We heard about your adventures as a mighty frog,"
Hodge added, chuckling,
"relying on the master to save you, scattering your essence like rain across the city."
"It's hardly his fault, though, is it?" Mwamba put in sympathetically.
Of all the rats, she was the most elegant and convincing. Ascable had one eye. Hodge had a row of poison spines among his bristles, and Cormac Odron, as always, looked more like a small brick outhouse than anything else. As for me, my essence was playing me up again. There were some hazy patches around my extremities, although I hoped they were too small for anyone to notice.
"Maybe not, but he's a liability on a job like this," Ascobol said. "Look at his outline now, all fuzzy."
"He'll slow us up. He was lagging when we flew."
"Yeah, and he'd be terrible in a fight. Probably subside into a custard."
A custard, another technical term, denotes a total collapse of essence while on the mortal plane. In the other place, of course, our essence is freewheeling at all times, and does not have to be bound in any particular shape.
"Well, you won't catch me scooping him up."
"Nor me. We're not on babysitting duty here."
"Your high opinion of my powers notwithstanding," I growled, "I'm the only one who's actually seen Hopkins. Go on without me if you want. See how far you get."
"He's getting huffy now,"
Hodge said in contemplative tones.
"Ego like a balloon. Watch out. It's going to pop."
Mwamba batted her tail irritably against the floor.
"We're wasting time. Bartimaeus may be decrepit, but we need his advice before we start."
She smiled as sweetly as a sewer rat can smile.
"Please go on, Bartimaeus. Tell us what you saw."
"You know me. I'm not one to hold grudges. At least, not when I can't do anything about them. But sooner or later, when I was back at full vigour, I'd meet Hodge, Ascobol, and Cormac Odron again. Then I'd apply delayed retribution with all the savage ferocity of a wounded bear. Successful vengeance is all about timing." I gave a careless shrug. "In truth, it isn't much. I saw Hopkins, but only briefly. Whether he's a magician or not, I can't say. I assume so. Certainly someone used a gang of foliots and gin to chase me off."
"Just a thought, this," Mwamba said. "You're sure he's human?"
"Hopkins? Yeah. I checked him out on all seven planes. Human on each one. If we can catch him by surprise, we should be able to hold him."
"Oh, I'll hold him,"
Hodge said in a dark, exulting voice.
"Don't you worry about that. I've got a snug place waiting for him, a place where ropes and shackles won't be needed, a place right here, under my skin."
He sniggered lovingly. The sound faded. The other four rats looked at each other. Askerbol said,
"I think we'll stick to plain old ropes, Hodge. Thanks for the offer. Right, to continue, we know Hopkins stays here. Any idea which room?"
I shrugged. "Not a clue."
"We'll have to check the book at reception. What then?"
Cormac Codron shifted his hairy bulk.
"We rampage upstairs, break down the door, beat Hopkins to a pulp, and spirit him away. Simple, efficient, satisfying. Next question."
I shook my head. "Tactically brilliant. But Hopkins might be alerted as we stomp upon the stairs. We must be subtle here."
Cormac Codron frowned.
"I'm not sure I do subtle."
"Besides," Mwamba said, "Hopkins may not yet have returned. We need to get to his room quietly and see. If he's away, we lurk within."
I nodded. Disguises are necessary, and in Hodge's case an additional bath and fumigation. Humans have a sense of smell, you know. The rat in question stirred indignantly, rattling his poison spines.
"Step this way, Bartimaeus. I wish to taste your essence."
"Oh, yes? Think you can take me? Nothing would be easier or more welcome."
For some while the argument proceeded, scintillating in its wit, verve, and skilful repartee. Sample dialogue. "Oh, so you reckon you can, eh?"
"Yeah, no problem, pal."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah."
All to a backdrop of the others whooping and slapping their hairy haunches. For intellectual reach and vigour, it was midway between the debates of ancient Athens and those of more recent English parliaments. But before I could rout my opponent with a final, devastating proof, a bloke came in to use the phone box, and the rats turned tail and scattered. 20 minutes passed. At the entrance to the Ambassador Hotel, the doorman paced rhythmically from side to side and clapped his hands together to keep warm. A group of guests approached, a woman and three men, all beautifully attired in suits of Silk Road cloth. They spoke quietly together in an Arabic tongue. The woman wore jewels of moonstone at her throat. Each gave off reassuring emanations of wealth, dignity, and social poise, with the possible exception of Cormac Codron, who still contrived to resemble a heifer shoehorned into a suit. The doorman stepped back, saluted. The four acknowledged him with nods and gracious smiles. They passed up the steps and into the hotel foyer. A young woman sat smiling behind a mahogany desk.
"Can I help you?"
The most handsome of the men approached. "Good evening. We are from the embassy of the Kingdom of Sheba. We have a royal party arriving in a few weeks, and wish to inspect your premises with a view to hiring rooms."
"Certainly, sir. Would you care to follow me? I will find the manager."
The receptionist rose from her desk and padded on light feet down a corridor. The four Sheban diplomats followed. As they did so, one opened a clenched fist. A small but unpleasant insect rose out, all legs, spines, and sulphurous odours, and flew on whirring wings to the vacated desk, where it proceeded to scan the register. The hotel manager was a small, amply padded lady of middle age. Her bone-grey hair was swept back and fixed in place by a piece of polished whalebone. She received her visitors with polite reserve.
"You are from the Sheban Embassy?"
I made a courteous bow. "That is correct, madam. Your perspicacity is beyond compare."
"Well, the girl just told me. But I was not aware that Sheba was an independent state. I thought it was part of the Arabian Confederacy."
I hesitated. All that is about to change, madam. We are shortly to become self-governing. It is to celebrate this that our royal guests are coming."
"I see. Dear me, self-government is a dangerous trend. I hope Sheba does not set an example to our empire. Well, I can certainly show you a typical room. This is a very prestigious hotel, as I'm sure you know, private and extremely exclusive. Its security systems have been authorized by government magicians. We have state-of-the-art door guard demons for every room."
"Is that so? Every single one?"
"Yes. Excuse me, Let me just get the appropriate key. I won't be a minute.
The manager bustled swiftly away. At this the female diplomat turned to me.
You idiot, Bartimaeus, she hissed. You swore she